Accession number 12385, rule 9.
Bill Williamson, number 9.
The strike committee, of which I was a member, meeting in Vancouver, decided to call all the relief camp workers to leave the camps and descend on Vancouver, and demanded that we be given relief, unemployment relief payment, enough to pay our rent and board and so on, or if they had their families there, to pay enough for their families to keep them there. And we came in there, and we had many very big demonstrations, not only with the relief camp workers, but the longshoremen came out in sympathy with us on one-day strikes, and other lumber camp workers and so on. So that I do remember at one time that we decided that we were going to tie up the whole of the traffic in downtown Vancouver, so that we had organized all the relief camp workers snaking in and out of the traffic there, piling it up. Then it was suggested to the people that we make a big demonstration in the Hudson Bay stores, which is one of the chief department stores in Vancouver. And so that we went there with the idea of, and I think the strike committee, I think I'm correct in saying, we decided that because it wouldn't give the police such a chance to use violence against us, that when we went into the store, we would go to the a second floor, that where they'd have to go up in the elevators and so on there. But some of the strikers disregarded that, and we all piled in. I and most of the committee members, of course, it was quite a big committee. I forget now, about 100 strong or so on, and composed not only of the relief camp strikers, but also the longshoremen supporters of that, and of course the unemployed of Vancouver itself, those that were married and so on, that they didn't shove off to the relief camps, and so that and I know they couldn't close the doors of the Hudson Bay store to us, and they didn't know quite who were who was what there, so that when you asked a sales girl, I want to see such and such a thing, they didn't know whether you were a striker, because although most of us were in sort of lumber jackets or mackinaws or so on, well, a great many of the people in Vancouver were dressed like that anyway, so that and the sales girls didn't know whether they were coming or going, and then the police waded in to us. They came into the store and they started striking out all over the place with the glass counters went flying, and the ordinary customers ran out of the stores. And of course, amongst those would be many of women and children, demonstrators too, from the unemployed, or even from workers in Vancouver. So that I do know this, that we had several meetings with the mayor in Vancouver, And he said he was going to do everything he could to press on the government of Bennett to insist on getting proper relief for them, but then went back on his word and had a meeting. I forget where it was now. I think it could have been at the War Memorial or something in Vancouver, where he read the Riot Act. I don't know actually what that meant, but it meant the troops could be employed and that sort of thing. But then we decided amongst the that this was now late spring, I suppose, that I'm not quite clear about the events, whether we went back to the camps or and then came out again. But in late spring, we decided that all the relief camps all over Canada were going to converge on Ottawa. And, of course, the only way to travel was by freight train, so that we organized it very, very, very well. And we had groups, sections, and platoons. Everyone, mostly with a rucksack of what the shaving materials, a towel, soap, and things like that. And then we went down to the freight yards in Vancouver, and I think we organized it in two contingents. The first contingent was about 4,000. And when the train was made up in the freight yards, these 4,000 clambered on the freight yard on the boxcars, and it was just like some movie with a revolt in Mexico or something, except we didn't have guns. We just all these single unemployed there manning them for the train.
How did the railway people react to that?
Well, they couldn't do anything, you see, that they had ordinary, you had your people, the train crew and so on. Even if you assembled all the train crews there, that there weren't going to be as many as 4,000 or even 400 or, you know, they just stood by and saw you clamber up on the train. They're generally sympathetic anyway, that they just climbed up on the boxcars and the train started off. And then I think it was about every 100 miles, maybe less, maybe 50 miles, we detrain then in the next town of any size. And of course they'd been the strike committee said warned the town officials and warned the government of BC. The government of BC was mildly sympathetic. I think it was two-faced, of course, because it wanted to curry favour, but I think it was a left-wing government at that time. CCF government, I'm not certain, but anyway, BC wanted us to hell out of their province, and every town we came to wanted the same. So they fitted up soup kitchens and tents, and mostly army bell tents of those. When we came to a town there, we found everything laid on. And masses of workers, sort of people sympathetic to the cause, women and coming out and cooking the food, bringing food, and shopkeepers even giving food. And I think town perhaps would give a meagre amount of money for providing food and so on, and just getting you shifted out. The next day, the next freight came along, and you clambered aboard again. And every stop we made, we added to the number that were flocking to us. And we heard there was this other freight, the other section following on behind. I think by this time our section had grown from about 4,000 to about 6,000 odd. And so that progressed all the way up through British Columbia through to Alberta, which again I think had a left wing government, but I'm not certain about that. And again, every stop we made, we added to the numbers, so that you had like an army on the move. Every town, you had these tents springing up, it's really never anything has been seen like this anywhere in the world before, and it wasn't given great prominence in the any of the Canadian papers. They must have got the word from the government to play it down. It was mentioned that a group of single unemployed men were making their way to Toronto and so on. And then eventually we got to Regina. By this time, I think the numbers had risen to about 8,000 or 9,000. Then we decided amongst the committee members that we'd negotiate with R.B. Bennett that if he would, but what we would do, we would send six of the committee members to Ottawa to talk with the Prime Minister, and six were selected, I used to know their names, but I can't remember it now. When they got there, the idea was, when they get here, they're going to big change with conditions. Conditions would be easier, but in fact, it all boiled down to when they got to Ottawa, Bennett tell them, get back to the camps or else, you see. So, they negotiated for 2 or 3 days. But I think they saw that really they were going to make no headway. And Bennett said he was going to use every force possible to prevent the strikers going any further east, that he wasn't going to have this. It was transmitted back to us, the rest of the strike committee in Regina, that we would call the thing off, the government would pay our fares back to wherever we wanted to go, on the train in a day coach sort of thing, Then on Dominion Day, they called it then, on July the 1st, it's now Canada Day, that we said, well, we'll have a big meeting with the townsfolk of Regina, which were very sympathetic to us. Again, I think the Saskatchewan government was a CCF government or a progressive government, opposed to Bennett, but again playing a two-faced job on the one hand being sympathetic to the strikers, another thing acceding to the federal government's every request. And we were located in the stadium in the city there that we were located there. And on July the 1st, we were going to have this meeting. Of course, July the 1st was a public holiday. And I was on the, I think we had two or three trucks with boards laid across for a platform. I'm not certain, but some sort of raised platform up about 6 foot higher than the crowd or something. And I was just at the back of this platform. And I remembered remarking it was a beautiful sunny day that only the sort of blazing hot days you get in the summer and the prairies there. And and then I saw some very big, do they call them pantechnicons or something? These very big removal trucks come up, big black painted trucks, very, very, and they pulled up on the far side of the square. And I remember saying, well, you know, that it's strange that they have these furniture removal, all covered over, of course, that they have these furniture removal vans here that, you know, today's a public holiday. And he said, oh, I suppose that's the reason, because they're shifting government furniture and it's a good day to shift it or something like that. And then suddenly they let down the ramps on the back of these two or three of these huge removal trucks, and out charged mounted police in their tin hats and wielding baseball bats, and also the provincial police and the city police too, all from different parts of the square came in. Several shots were fired by the mounted police. Of course, we didn't have guns or anything, but I suppose this was... and by this time, we'd already said to the crowd and the committee that were meeting with Bennett and the government in Washington said, well, we agree, we'll return to our homes and we'll return peaceably. So they already knew this. And this meeting was farewell meeting for the people of Regina to thank them for their hospitality and help and so on. And there were literally thousands of people from Regina with their families. It was like a holiday, and not so many relief camp strikers, because they felt, well, you know, it's the end. What's the use of having any more meetings? And we'll just go back and go for a swim, I think, to a river somewhere ways away. And there was a big minority, but it was mostly townsfolk there. And then these police laid into them with... and then I think they started firing tear gas and thing. And of course, there was nowhere to run, because every exit from this square was blocked by police. So the people were milling around, didn't know where to go. That I and the others then sort of jumped off the platform. And for one thing, I think the police were making for the platform to arrest all the leaders on the platform. We all jumped down and mingled with the crowd, and also took part in fighting the police there. That in the end, I don't know quite how it happened, but one policeman was killed, shot, and I think he was shot by one of their own people. But literally hundreds injured in this, they call it the Dominion Day Massacre in that. And then we made our way back to the stadium, and the which was ringed then by the mounted police, all in their tin hats and with rifles. And at the edge of the stadium, there was a railroad track running, and there was this two or three boxcars on this. It was just a switching place for bringing stuff into the stadium. And there was this boxcar, and on top of it were some mounted police with a machine gun. Everyone that of the relief camp strikers, they weren't allowed to leave the camp or enter the camp or anything. That one other fellow and myself, another member of the committee, we crawled underneath this barbed wire on the side. It's a bit vague now. This barbed wire wasn't laid just for our benefit. It was just as a sort of general protection for the stadium, I think, at the rear of the stadium. It was quite impossible to get out on any train leaving, either a passenger or a freight train. This fellow and myself decided on something that we'd never heard done for before. We had both had Mackinaws, heavy Mackinaws on, and we decided to run, climb on top of the cow catcher underneath the smokestack of the engine there and hang on there. It's surprising there that when the headlight is on of the engine, people can be looking directly at you, and as long as you make no movement at all, they don't see you.
So you were going to climb on the fender on the front of the engine?
The very front of the engine, underneath the boiler, the two of us hung there. We said we hoped that this blinding headlight would blind everyone. That I had had instances of that before, of looking. It's like looking at the sun and then you can't say anything. So, but we said, you know, whatever happens, even if people, you mustn't make any sort of movement, because if you do, then... So we hung on there, and the train was, of course, already made up, and we were we made it from the front of the station there got ahead. Then clung on for dear life, and although it was midsummer, and we had the Mackinaws pull right over our heads, it was freezing cold with the express train going through the night. I think we made it for the first section. Then we got off there. I don't know what town it was, and then we washed up a bit. And then we went into the station, and then we had some money and booked through our seats to Winnipeg.
Can I just stop you there, yes. Bill? Can I go back a little bit?
Yes.
When you were on the Ottawa track, on the Great Ottawa track, yes. Were you a section leader at all on that track? On the trek, rather.
On the trek?
On the Ottawa trek.
No, I was one of the committee members.
Yeah.
The committee members weren't necessarily section leaders, that although some of them may have been, but they delegated someone. Someone had to be in charge as a section leader. It was just more or less marshalling the... getting the people to get onto the train at the right time, and each you're going to take this boxcar and so on. And I think each section was about 20 men or something like that.
And what did you do on the committee? What was your role on the committee?
Well, the question was the role of... educating the people, and also the sort of getting them to Ottawa to and then present our demands to the government, which we'd hope to do in an organized way. That also the committee also had the job of negotiating with different townsfolk and so on about help for the strikers on the way up there, that getting as much help from each town and so on.
And were you in a political party at this time?
Yes, I was in the Communist Party, but not necessarily everyone was there, but most of the committee members were from the Communist Party, I would think, 70%.
And how long had you been in the Communist Party at this stage?
Oh, I think, let's see, this was about... this was about 1934. Oh, about 10 years, I think it must have been about 10 years.
And the other thing I want to ask you is, what was the spirit and the atmosphere like among the men going on?
Oh,
the
track? The wonderful spirit of comradeship, and we're going to beat Bennett to hell, and all this sort of thing that. Generally that we were going to win our demands. And when the committees phoned back from Ottawa saying, well, you know, we have to see that it is impossible to go on if the whole of the state's going to be organized against us. Oh, and incidentally, I think that comes a bit later. I'll come that that when we got to Winnipeg, the two of us, we made, there was also another very big, because Winnipeg's a very big, at that time, left-wing a group there, Manitoba. Had a left-wing, I don't think the legislature, no, that wasn't left-wing, but the mass of the people were very leftish there. That they also, many people had come from outlying districts, outlying relief camps, and when they found they couldn't get to BC, they sort of congregated on Winnipeg, so that there was, I suppose, about 2,000 people in Winnipeg. When we reached, the two of us reached Winnipeg, and we went to see the strike committee, and also where they were all holed up in the... they were in some sort of hall. It could be a Labour Defence League hall. I don't know what it was, but it was big enough to hold about 2,000 there anyway. But it was ringed by police, so that it was very difficult. I think we had to wait till nightfall, and we were able to get there. And when we got there, there was a wonderful feeling there. The women auxiliaries, I think they call them, were bringing in hot chocolate and coffee and tea and cookies and everything there. Everyone was singing the International or Hold the Fort for We Are Coming, Union Men Be Strong, all the different union songs and so on. They decided, well, they put an edict on the train, Bennett, that no longer could the Canadian railways be used for the transportation of these people to Ottawa. So that we thought, well, we'll continue the trek. And that is so that the committee... And they sort of co-opted me and this other fellow onto the committee there in Winnipeg. They said, well, after this, we won't contravene the law by going on trains. We'll do it quite legitimately. and they hired a whole fleet of buses, each one holding, you know, they weren't Greyhound buses, but the same size, actually. What do they hold? About 40, 50 people, I suppose. They're about 20, I don't know what it was. There was well over 1,000 anyway there that... they've got these buses there, and then we sneaked out. Snaked out one after the other. These buses all up Portage Avenue, heading east, and nothing was said, or they were a bit nonplussed. The Mounties, you know, because they couldn't beat us back. We legitimately hired these buses. I don't know where they got the money from, but must have cost quite a bit. And then we proceeded, and again we had the same tactic of about every, 100 miles or 50 miles where we stopped, one or two stops, and then we got to Kenora, which is